Chapter 35. Tombs and Tombs Only? Climbing down the Great Pyramid was more nerve-wracking than climbing up. We were no longer struggling against the force of gravity, so the physical effort was less, but the possibilities of a fatal fall seemed greatly magnified now that our attention was directed exclusively towards the ground rather than the heavens. We picked our way with exaggerated care towards the base of the enormous mountain of stone, sliding and slithering among the treacherous masonry blocks, feeling as though we had been reduced to ants. By the time we had completed the descent, the night was over, and the first wash of pale sunlight was filtering into the sky. We paid the 50 Egyptian pounds, promised to the guard of the pyramid's western face, and then, with a tremendous sense of release and exultation, we walked jauntily away from the monument in the direction of the Pyramid of Khafre, a few hundred meters to the southwest. Khufu, Khafre, Menkaure, Cheops, Chephren, Mycerinus. Whether they were referred to by their Egyptian or their Greek names, the fact remained that these three pharaohs of the Fourth Dynasty, 2575 to 2467 BC, were universally acclaimed as the builders of the Giza pyramids. This had been the case at least since ancient Egyptian tour guides had told the Greek historian Herodotus that the Great Pyramid had been built by Khufu. Herodotus had incorporated this information into the oldest surviving written description of the monuments, which continued, "Cheops, they said, reigned for 50 years, and on his death the kingship was taken over by his brother Chephren. He also made a pyramid. It is 40 feet lower than his brother's pyramid, but otherwise of the same greatness. Chephren reigned for 56 years. Then there succeeded Mycerinus, the son of Cheops. This man left a pyramid much smaller than his father's." Herodotus saw the monuments in the 5th century BC, more than 2,000 years after they'd been built. Nevertheless, it was largely on the foundation of his testimony that the entire subsequent judgment of history was based. All other commentators, up to the present, continued uncritically to follow in the Greek historian's footsteps. And down the ages, although it had originally been little more than hearsay, the attribution of the Great Pyramid to Khufu, the Second Pyramid to Khafre, and the Third Pyramid to Menkaure had assumed the stature of unassailable fact. Trivializing the mystery. Having parted company with Ali, Sartha and I continued our walk into the desert. Skirting the immense southwestern corner of the second pyramid, our eyes were drawn towards its summit. There we noted again the intact facing stones that still covered its top 22 courses. We also noticed that the first few courses above its base, each of which had a footprint of about a dozen acres, were composed of truly massive blocks of limestone, almost too high to clamber over, which were about 20 feet long and 6 feet thick. These extraordinary monoliths, as I was later to discover, weighed 200 tons apiece and belonged to a distinct style of masonry to be found at several different and widely scattered locations within the Giza necropolis. On its north and west sides, the second pyramid sat on a level platform cut down out of the surrounding bedrock and was thus enclosed within a wide trench, more than 15 feet deep in places. Walking due south, parallel to the monument's scarred western flank, we picked our way along the edge of this trench towards the much smaller third pyramid, which lay some 400 meters ahead of us in the desert. Khufu, Khafre, Menkaure. According to all orthodox Egyptologists, the pyramids had been built as tombs, and only as tombs, for these three pharaohs. Yet there were some obvious difficulties with such assertions. For example, the spacious burial chamber of the Khafre pyramid was empty when it was opened in 1818 by the European explorer Giovanni Belzoni. Indeed, more than empty, the chamber was starkly, austerely bare. The polished granite sarcophagus, which lay embedded in its floor, had also been found empty, with its lid broken in two pieces nearby. How was this to be explained? To Egyptologists, the answer seemed obvious. At some early date, probably not many hundreds of years after Khafre's death, Tomb robbers must have penetrated the chamber and cleared all its contents, including the mummified body of the pharaoh. Much the same thing seemed to have happened at the smaller third pyramid, towards which Santa and I were now walking, that attributed to Menkaure. Here the first European to break in had been a British colonel, Howard Vyse, who had entered the burial chamber in 1837. He found an empty basalt sarcophagus, an anthropoid coffin lid made of wood, and some bones. The natural assumption was that these were the remains of Menkaure. Modern science had subsequently proved, however, that the bones and the coffin lid dated from the early Christian era, that is, from 2,500 years after the Pyramid Age, and thus represented the intrusive burial of a much later individual, quite a common practice throughout ancient Egyptian history. As to the basalt sarcophagus, well, it could have belonged to Menkaure. Unfortunately, however, nobody had the opportunity to examine it, because it had been lost at sea when the ship on which Vyse sent it to England had sunk off the coast of Spain. Since it was a matter of record that the sarcophagus had been found empty by Vyse, it was once again assumed that the body of the pharaoh must have been removed by tomb robbers. A similar assumption had been made about the body of Khufu, which was also missing. Here the scholarly consensus, expressed as well as anyone by George Hart of the British Museum, was that no later than 500 years after Khufu's funeral, robbers had forced their way into the Great Pyramid to steal the burial treasure. The implication is that this incursion must have occurred by or before 2000 BC, since Khufu is believed to have died in 2528 BC. Moreover, it was assumed by Professor I.E.S. Edwards, a leading authority on these matters, that the burial treasure had been removed from the famous inner sanctum, now known as the King's Chamber, and that the empty granite sarcophagus, which stood at the western end of that sanctum, had once contained the king's body, probably enclosed within an inner coffin made of wood. All this is orthodox, mainstream, modern scholarship, which is unquestioningly accepted as historical fact and taught as such at universities everywhere. But suppose it isn't fact. The cupboard was bare. The mystery of the missing mummy of Khufu begins with the records of Caliph al-Ma'mun, a Muslim governor of Cairo in the 9th century AD. He had engaged a team of quarriers to tunnel their way into the pyramid's northern face, urging them on with promises that they would discover treasure. Through a series of lucky accidents, Ma'mun's hole, as archaeologists now refer to it, had joined up with one of the monument's several internal passageways, the descending corridor, leading downwards from the original concealed doorway in the northern face, the location of which, though known in classical times, had been forgotten by Ma'mun's day. By a further lucky accident, the vibrations that the Arabs had caused with their battering rams and drills dislodged a block of limestone from the ceiling of the descending corridor. When the socket from which it had fallen was examined, it was found to conceal the opening to another corridor, this time ascending into the bowels of the pyramid. There was a problem, however. The opening was blocked by a series of enormous plugs of solid granite, clearly contemporaneous with the construction of the monument, which were held in place by a narrowing of the lower end of the corridor. The quarriers were unable either to break or to cut through the plugs. They therefore tunneled into the slightly softer limestone surrounding them, and after several weeks of back-breaking toil, rejoined the ascending corridor higher up, having bypassed a formidable obstacle never before breached. The implications were obvious. Since no previous treasure seekers had penetrated this far, the interior of the pyramid must still be virgin territory. The diggers must have licked their lips with anticipation at the immense quantities of gold and jewels they could now expect to find. Similarly, though perhaps for different reasons, Ma'mun must have been impatient to be the first into any chambers that lay ahead. It was reported that his primary motive in initiating this investigation had not been an ambition to increase his vast personal wealth, but a desire to gain access to a storehouse of ancient wisdom and technology, which he believed to lie buried within the monument. In this repository, according to age-old tradition, the pyramid builders had placed instruments of iron and arms which rust not, and glass which might be bended and yet not broken, and strange spells. But Mahmoon and his men found nothing, not even any down-to-earth treasure, and certainly not any high-tech, anachronistic, plastic or instruments of iron or rust-proof weapons or strange spells either. The erroneously named Queen's Chamber, which lay at the end of a long horizontal passageway that branched off from the ascending corridor, turned out to be completely empty, just a severe geometrical room. More disappointing still, the King's Chamber, which the Arabs reached after climbing the imposing Grand Gallery, also offered little of interest. Its only furniture was a granite coffer, just big enough to contain the body of a man. Later identified on no very good grounds as a sarcophagus, this undecorated stone box was approached with trepidation by Mahmoud and his team, who found it to be lidless and as empty as everything else in the pyramid. Why, how, and when exactly had the Great Pyramid been emptied of its contents? Had it been 500 years after Khufu's death, as the Egyptologists suggested, or was it not more likely, as the evidence was beginning to suggest, that the inner chambers of the pyramid had been empty all along, from the very beginning, that is, from the day that the monument had originally been sealed? Nobody, after all, had reached the upper part of the ascending corridor before Mahmoud and his men, and it was certain, too, that nobody had cut through the granite plugs blocking the entrance to that corridor. Common sense ruled out the possibility of any earlier incursion, unless there was another way in. Bottlenecks in the well shaft. There was another way in. Farther down the descending corridor, more than 200 feet beyond the point where the plugged end of the ascending corridor had been found, lies the concealed entrance to another secret passageway, deep within the subterranean bedrock of the Giza Plateau. If Mahmoud had discovered this passageway, he could have saved himself a great deal of trouble, since it provided a ready-made route around the plugs blocking the ascending corridor. His attention, however, had been distracted by the challenge of tunneling past those plugs, and he made no effort to investigate the lower reaches of the descending corridor, which he ended up using as a dump for the tons of stone his diggers removed from the core of the pyramid. The full extent of the descending corridor was, however, well known and explored in classical times. The Greco-Roman geographer Strabo left quite a clear description of the large subterranean chamber it debouched into, at a depth of almost 600 feet below the apex of the pyramid. Graffiti from the period of the Roman occupation of Egypt was also found inside this underground chamber, confirming that it had once been regularly visited. Yet because it had been so cunningly hidden in the beginning, the secret doorway leading off to one side about two-thirds of the way down the western wall of the descending corridor remained sealed and undiscovered until the 19th century. What the doorway led to was a narrow well shaft, about 160 feet in extent, which rose almost vertically through the bedrock and then through more than 20 complete courses of the Great Pyramid's limestone core blocks, until it joined up with the main internal corridor system at the base of the Grand Gallery. There is no evidence to indicate what the purpose of this strange architectural feature might have been, although several scholars have hazarded guesses. Indeed, the only thing that is clear is that it was engineered at the time of the construction of the pyramid and was not the result of an intrusion by tunneling tomb robbers. The question remains open, however, as to whether tomb robbers might have discovered the hidden entrance to the shaft and made use of it to siphon off the treasures from the king's and queen's chambers. Such a possibility cannot be ruled out. Nevertheless, a review of the historical record indicates little in its favor. For example, the upper end of the well shaft was entered off the Grand Gallery by the Oxford astronomer John Greaves in 1638. He managed to descend to a depth of about 60 feet. In 1765, another Briton, Nathaniel Davison, penetrated to a depth of about 150 feet, but found his way blocked by an impenetrable mass of sand and stones. Later, in the 1830s, Captain G. B. Caviglia, an Italian adventurer, reached the same depth and encountered the same obstacle. More enterprising than his predecessors, he hired Arab workers to start excavating the rubble in the hope that there might be something of interest beneath it. Several days of digging in claustrophobic conditions followed before the connection with the descending corridor was discovered. Is it likely that such a cramped, blocked-up shaft could have been a viable conduit for the treasures of Khufu, supposedly the greatest pharaoh of the magnificent Fourth Dynasty? Even if it hadn't been choked with debris and sealed at the lower end, it could not have been used to bring out more than a tiny fraction of the treasures of a typical royal tomb. This is because the well shaft is only 3 feet in diameter and incorporates several tricky vertical sections. At the very least, therefore, when Mamun and his men battered their way into the king's chamber around the year AD 820, one would have expected some of the bigger and heavier pieces from the original burial still to be in place, like the statues and shrines that bulked so large in Tutankhamun's much later and presumably inferior tomb. But nothing was found inside Khufu's pyramid, making this and the alleged looting of Khafre's monument the only tomb robberies in the history of Egypt which achieved a clean sweep, leaving not a single trace behind, not a torn cloth, not a shard of broken pottery, not an unwanted figurine, not an overlooked piece of jewelry, just the bare floors and walls and the gaping mouths of empty sarcophagi. Not like other tombs. It was now after 6 in the morning, and the rising sun had bathed the summits of Khufu's and Khafre's pyramids with a fleeting blush of pastel pink light. Menkaure's pyramid, being some 200 feet lower than the other two, was still in shadow, as Santha and I skirted its northwestern corner and continued our walk into the rolling sand dunes of the surrounding desert. I still had the tomb robbery theory on my mind. As far as I could see, the only real evidence in favor of it was the absence of grave goods and mummies that it had been invented to explain in the first place. All the other facts, particularly where the Great Pyramid was concerned, seemed to speak persuasively against any robbery having occurred. It was not just a matter of the narrowness and unsuitability of the well shaft as an escape route for bulky treasures. The other remarkable feature of Khufu's pyramid was the absence of inscriptions or decorations anywhere within its immense network of galleries, corridors, passageways and chambers, and the same was true of Khafre's and Menkaure's pyramids. In none of these amazing monuments had a single word been written in praise of the pharaohs whose bodies they were supposed to house. This was exceptional. No other proven burial place of any Egyptian monarch had ever been found undecorated. The fashion throughout Egyptian history had been for the tombs of the pharaohs to be extensively decorated, beautifully painted from top to bottom, as in the Valley of Kings at Luxor, for example, and densely inscribed with the ritual spells and invocations required to assist the deceased on his journey towards eternal life, as in the Fifth Dynasty pyramids at Saqqara, just 20 miles to the south of Giza. Why had Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure done things so differently? Had they not built their monuments to serve as tombs at all, but for another and more subtle purpose? Or was it possible, as certain Arab and esoteric traditions maintained, that the Giza pyramids had been erected long before the Fourth Dynasty, by the architects of some earlier and more advanced civilization? Neither hypothesis was popular with Egyptologists, for reasons that were easy to understand. Moreover, while conceding that the second and third pyramids were completely devoid of internal inscriptions, lacking even the names of Khafre and Menkaure, the scholars were able to cite certain hieroglyphic quarry marks, graffiti daubed on stone blocks before they left the quarry, found inside the Great Pyramid, which did seem to bear the name of Khufu. A certain smell. The discoverer of the quarry marks was Colonel Howard Weiss, during the destructive excavations he undertook at Giza in 1837. Extending an existing crawlway, he cut a tunnel into the series of narrow cavities called relieving chambers, which lay directly above the king's chamber. The quarry marks were found on the walls and ceilings of the top four of these cavities, and said things like this: "The craftsman gang, how powerful is the white crown of Khnum Khufu? Khufu, Khnum Khufu, year 17. It was all very convenient, right at the end of a costly and otherwise fruitless digging season, just when a major archaeological discovery was needed to legitimize the expenses he'd run up. Vyse had stumbled upon the find of the decade, the first incontrovertible proof that Khufu had indeed been the builder of the hitherto anonymous Great Pyramid. One would have thought that a discovery of this nature would have settled conclusively any lingering doubts over the ownership and purpose of that enigmatic monument. But the doubts remained, largely because, from the beginning, a certain smell hung over Vyse's evidence. 1. It was odd that the marks were the only signs of the name Khufu ever found anywhere inside the Great Pyramid. 2. It was odd that they had been found in such an obscure, out-of-the-way corner of that immense building. 3. It was odd that they had been found at all in a monument otherwise devoid of inscriptions of any kind. 4. It was extremely odd that they had been found only in the top four of the five relieving chambers. Inevitably, suspicious minds began to wonder whether quarry marks might also have appeared in the lowest of these five chambers had that chamber too been discovered by Vyse, rather than by Nathaniel Davison 70 years earlier. 5. Last but not least, it was odd that several of the hieroglyphs in the quarry marks had been painted upside down, and that some were unrecognizable, while others had been misspelt or used ungrammatically. Was Vyse a forger? I know of one plausible case made to suggest he was exactly that, and although final proof will probably always be lacking, it seemed to me incautious of academic Egyptology to have accepted the authenticity of the quarry marks without question. Besides, there was alternative hieroglyphic evidence, arguably of purer provenance, which appeared to indicate that Khufu could not have built the Great Pyramid. Strangely, the same Egyptologists who readily ascribed immense importance to Vyse's quarry marks were quick to downplay the significance of these other contradictory hieroglyphs, which appeared on a rectangular limestone stela which now stood in the Cairo Museum. The inventory stela, as it was called, had been discovered at Giza in the 19th century by the French archaeologist Auguste Mariette. It was something of a bombshell, because its text clearly indicated that both the Great Sphinx and the Great Pyramid, as well as several other structures on the plateau, were already in existence long before Khufu came to the throne. The inscription also referred to Isis as the mistress of the pyramid, implying that the monument had been dedicated to the goddess of magic, and not to Khufu at all. Finally, there was a strong suggestion that Khufu's pyramid might have been one of the three subsidiary structures alongside the Great Pyramid's eastern flank. All this looked like damaging evidence against the orthodox chronology of ancient Egypt. It also challenged the consensus view that the Giza pyramids had been built as tombs and only as tombs. However, rather than investigating the anachronistic statements in the inventory stela, Egyptologists chose to devalue them. In the words of the influential American scholar James Henry Breasted, these references would be of the highest importance if the stela were contemporaneous with Khufu, but the orthographic evidences of its late date are entirely conclusive. Breasted meant that the nature of the hieroglyphic writing system used in the inscription was not consistent with that used in the Fourth Dynasty, but belonged to a more recent epoch. All Egyptologists concurred with this analysis, and the final judgment, still accepted today, was that the stela had been carved in the 21st Dynasty, about 1,500 years after Khufu's reign, and was therefore to be regarded as a work of historical fiction. Thus, citing orthographic evidence, an entire academic discipline found reason to ignore the boat-rocking implications of the inventory stellar, and at no time gave proper consideration to the possibility that it could have been based upon a genuine 4th Dynasty inscription, just as the New English Bible, for example, is based on a much older original. Exactly the same scholars, however, had accepted the authenticity of a set of dubious quarry marks without demur, turning a blind eye to their orthographic and other peculiarities. Why the double standard? Could it have been because the information contained in the quarry marks conformed strictly to orthodox opinion that the Great Pyramid had been built as a tomb for Khufu, whereas the information in the inventory stela contradicted that opinion? Overview. By 7 in the morning, Santa and I had walked far out into the desert to the southwest of the Giza pyramids and had made ourselves comfortable in the lee of a huge dune that offered an unobstructed panorama over the entire site. The date, 16th of March, was just a few days away from the spring equinox, one of the two occasions in the year when the sun rose precisely due east of wherever you stood in the world. Ticking out the days like the pointer of a giant metronome, it had bisected the horizon this morning at a point a hair's breadth south of due east, and had already climbed high enough to shrug off the Nile mists, which clung like a shroud to much of the city of Cairo. Khufu, Khafre, Menkaure, Cheops, Chephren, Mycerinus, whether you called them by their Egyptian or their Greek names, there was no doubt that the three famous pharaohs of the 4th Dynasty had been commemorated by the most splendid, the most honorable, the most beautiful, and the most enormous monuments ever seen anywhere in the world. Moreover, it was clear that these pharaohs must indeed have been closely associated with the monuments, not only because of the folklore passed on by Herodotus, which surely had some basis in fact, but because inscriptions and references to Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure had been found in moderate quantities outside the three major pyramids at several different parts of the Giza necropolis. Such finds had been made consistently in and around the six subsidiary pyramids, three of which lay to the east of the Great Pyramid and the other three to the south of the Menkaure Pyramid. Since much of this external evidence was ambiguous and uncertain, I found it difficult to understand why the Egyptologists were happy to go on citing it as confirmation of the tombs and tombs-only theory. The problem was that this same evidence was capable of supporting, as equally valid, a number of different and mutually contradictory interpretations. To give just one example, the close association observed between the three Great Pyramids and the three 4th Dynasty pharaohs could indeed have come about because these pharaohs had built the pyramids as their tombs. But it could also have come about if the gigantic monuments of the Giza Plateau had been standing long before the dawn of the historical civilization known as Dynastic Egypt. In that case, it was only necessary to assume that in due course Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure had come along and built a number of the subsidiary structures around the three older pyramids, something that they would have had every reason to do, because in this way they could have appropriated the high prestige of the original anonymous monuments and would almost certainly be viewed by posterity as their builders. There were other possibilities too. The point was, however, that the evidence for exactly who had built which Great Pyramid, when, and for what purpose, was far too thin on the ground to justify the dogmatism of the orthodox tombs and tombs-only theory. In all honesty, it was not clear who built the pyramids. It was not clear in what epoch they had been built, and it was not at all clear what their function had been. For all these reasons, they were surrounded by a wonderful, impenetrable air of mystery, and as I gazed down at them out of the desert, they seemed to march towards me across the dunes.